So when you walk down the aisle at the grocery store and you see Domino's sugar sitting on the shelf, what emotions does that evoke? How does that make you feel?
Well, one thing is I'm just aware of how many people died and how many lives were ruined to produce this product.
From the Ratner team, this is the Brooklyn Made podcast, a show about Brooklyn real estate, entrepreneurs, businesses, and the professionals behind one of the hottest real estate markets in the world. The Brooklyn Made show is a one-stop shop for anyone interested in New York real estate, entrepreneurship, and business. On the show, you'll learn valuable insights from New York's industry leaders, stay up to date with the latest local real estate and business news, follow market trends, listen to exciting local stories, and much more. Each month, our show will feature local entrepreneurs, professionals, and real estate experts that we are eager for you to meet. Our Brooklyn Made Real Estate Show is sponsored by Spartan Renovations, your high-end renovation contractor servicing Brooklyn, Manhattan, and surrounding areas. The quality of the work speaks for itself. Check out their website to see what I mean at SpartanRenovations.com. Contact Spartan today for a free consultation at 866-877-2782 or via email at contact@SpartanRenovations.com. If you are interested in sponsoring our podcast or advertising on our Brooklyn Made blog and giving your company the exposure of our audience and network, get in touch with us today at 347-762-0275 or email us at contact@brooklynmade.blog.
Welcome to the Brooklyn Made Show. I am Suzanne Lynn, and I am so extra excited about today's show. We are joined today by author Jeffrey Cobb. He's going to be talking about the book he wrote. It's called The Rise and Fall of the Sugar King, and you can get that at Amazon or online, a lot of bookstores. He'll talk about that. I can guarantee that you're never going to walk through the grocery store, spot a bag of sugar, and think of it in the same way again. I mean, he has mind-boggling stories about what it costs to create the sugar industry. And be sure to stick around to the end because we've got a really special surprise for you. So, Jeffrey, we are so honored that you are here. Let's start at the very beginning with Domino Sugar. It starts out with the two brothers, Henry and Theodore. Let's pick up from there.
Henry took over the marketing of the sugar, and Theodore controlled the technical aspects. And they proved to be very, very successful. They continued to enlarge the refinery. But after the Civil War, more and more people realized that you could make money refining sugar. So competition increased. They had to cut prices. And it became a real fight for survival.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, go ahead and talk about the conditions of the refinery. It's really shocking.
Yeah, so one of the things that really interested me was why did they pick this Polish-speaking immigrant workforce? And a lot of the reason why they wanted an immigrant, non-English-speaking workforce is that the workers would be, one, desperate to get any job, and the work in the refinery was literally hell on earth. They worked 12-hour days in temperatures that range from 110 to 130 degrees. Wow. At almost 100% humidity. Most of the sugar workers worked in loincloths because they just sweat profusely. They were given beer at cost because if they didn't, people would literally sweat out so much salt that they would pass out. And then after a few months in the refinery, even strong men, vigorous men who went in, were noticeable on the street for being gaunt, for just having the life drained out of them. And there were a number of industrial accidents. So what happened inside of the refinery is that there was sugar in the air. The air that you breathed in was filled with sugar, which would cause rashes. A lot of these men had red rashes all over their bodies. Also, breathing in sugar would start to affect their lungs. They would get hacking coughs. But also the walkways and the catwalks in the sugar refinery became coated with sugar, which is slippery and sticky. So you can imagine at the end of one of these 12-hour shifts, you're lightheaded, right? and you're walking on a slippery surface, and many, many men fell right into the vats, or their arms were chopped off in horrendous accidents. And once this happened, they were just dismissed. There was no workers' compensation, right? And the reason why we don't have more information is because the Havemeyers had a strict policy of not letting journalists into the plant, and then many of these men could not speak English and could not tell their stories. We do know that there were days when the Havemeyers were sure that men would die on the hottest summer days. And remember, we're talking about the 1870s, long before there was air conditioning, long before there was electricity to ventilate the plant. And yet the plant never stopped. So we know that in one day, 8 men died. We know that there were days when literally a quarter of the workforce passed out because of the intense heat and humidity. And yet when the workers tried to organize and demand a shorter day and higher pay, the Havemeyers sent no way and forced, closed down the plant and forced the workers to come back and blackballed the leaders of the strike.
And there was a lot of turmoil within the politics, not just in America, but really around the world because of this.
We have to talk about a defining moment in the history of the fact that in 1882, there was a massive fire that completely engulfed the factory and burned it to the ground. It was $1.5 million loss in dollars in 1882, which I would imagine would be equivalent to maybe $1.5 billion today. Mm. The Havemeyers pulled all of the family money. The Christian Havemeyer sold his estate, and they raised money. And in a year and a half, they rebuilt the refinery, and they rebuilt to make the new refinery the largest and most efficient sugar refinery in the world. And that building is the one that we see today. So it dates from 1883. And to give you some kind of context, right, it took 11 years to build the Brooklyn Bridge. The sugar refinery was taller than the Brooklyn Bridge, and they built it in a year and a half.
Wow.
So it was an amazing feat.
Mm-hmm.
But in 1886, the workers in the refinery said, enough is enough. And all along the Brooklyn waterfront, the workers struck, and there were really pitched battles between the police and the strikers, and skulls were cracked. The police had to fire in the air, but eventually the strike was broken. So there's a large, long history of violence surrounding the workers.
I mean, the sugar industry really shaped not just the economy, but the skyline when it comes to the sugar industry. What would the city have become without it?
Well, I mean, it's an interesting question. Possibly Williamsburg would have developed like Brooklyn Heights. In the 1830s, there was a vision of Williamsburg being a beautiful residential town, kind of a New England style town, and there were a number of mansions that were built. In 1837, there was an economic crash, right? And this bubble, this real estate bubble that emerged in Williamsburg burst. So what happened is there were large tracts of undeveloped lands that eventually ended up as sugar refineries. And from about 1870 to well after the First World War, the largest industry in Brooklyn, right, was sugar refining. It employed tens of thousands of people. And huge, huge fortunes were made out of the sugar refining industry. One of the things that I talk about in the book is the Havemeyer's connection to art. So Henry Havemeyer remarried his wife's niece, who was born in New York City, but as a young woman, she was brought to Paris, and she became aware that the great wave that was going to come through the art world was Impressionism. So on her own, she independently bought the first Degas and the first Monet by an American. But when she married Henry Havemeyer, she had huge amounts of money at her disposal. And every year they would go to Europe and they would buy great art. And there was an exhibit at the Metropolitan dedicated to the Havemeyers called The Splendid Legacy. And really, 1,000 of the most important pieces of art in the Metropolitan Museum were donated by Louisine Havemeyer when she died in the 1920s.
Now, did that come from the mansion that was facing Central Park?
They had an amazing mansion on 6th Street and 5th Avenue. And it's a pity that this building did not survive. The interior was decorated by Louis Comfort Tiffany, and that was a radical departure because before that, the nouveau riche, the robber barons, had slavishly towed to French tastes. And Havemeyer said, no, we're going to do something that's uniquely American. It was a gorgeous interior, but one of the things that was amazing was a room that contained 8 Rembrandts. Louisine encouraged Henry to start buying Impressionism. So part of the reason why the Metropolitan has this amazing collection of Impressionism is thanks to Louisine Havemeyer. But all of that art was bought with sugar money. That was made along the Brooklyn waterfront.
Jeff, let's go ahead and talk about the Sugar Trust.
So into the 1880s, the competition became cutthroat, and the producers realized that the only way that they could survive was by coming to some kind of agreement. And basically what they wanted to do was to limit the amount of sugar that they produced and to raise the price. So they were looking to form a cartel. They all knew each other. They were all largely German Americans. And then finally in 1887, Henry Havemeyer convinced the major refiners to set up the Sugar Trust. And they realized that they were doing something that was not only unethical, but largely illegal. But what they did is they created a vehicle whereby they all agreed that Henry Havemeyer would set the price of American sugar, and they would limit the amount of sugar that they produced. And this started to make the members of the trust incredibly wealthy. And it affected the American economy. It was the Sugar Trust was one of the largest American companies, massively profitable. There's also really interesting connection. So in 1858, when the refinery opened, most of the sugar came from Louisiana. Obviously, with the start of the Civil War and the South's secession, that supply of sugar was cut off. And the major supplier of sugar became Cuba. So tons and tons of Cuban sugar came from the island to Williamsburg, Brooklyn, where it was refined. There was sugar from all over the world as well. There was also sugar from Puerto Rico, from Egypt, from Brazil, but largely from Cuba. And before I started to do the research on this book, the Spanish-American War never quite made sense to me. But now I understand it. And some people call the Spanish-American War Havemeyer's War. Because Henry Havemeyer vigorously pushed the American government to start war with Spain.
What was his motivation for that?
He wanted to buy up the sugar plantations, where the raw sugar was raised that he refined in his Williamsburg refinery. So the Spanish-American War can largely be seen as a war for sugar interests.
It's all about money, right?
Right. And then one of the things they did as soon as Cuba was freed from Spain and Puerto Rico became an American territory is that they reconfigured the economy to massively export sugar. They built railroads, they built infrastructure, ports, everything. So Habermeyer had a total domination of the sugar, of every aspect of the sugar industry.
You are listening to The Brooklyn Made Show, sponsored by the Ratner Team. Follow us on iTunes, YouTube, or our blog at brooklynmade.blog. King's Auto Group is well known throughout Brooklyn for offering the best customer service in the business. Located just off the Bell Parkway at Exit 8, King's Auto Group has stocked their inventory full of certified Nissan and Infiniti vehicles. Looking for a classy, dependable car at the best possible price and the highest level customer service experience? Check out the King's Auto Group and visit them online at kingsautogroup.com. That's kingsautogroup.com. Or you can reach them at 718-646-3331. That's 718-646-3331.
Jeff, I want to jump back real quick. Just talk about the art that's in the Met Museum. Do you feel like they have a responsibility to talk about the money and the history behind the art hanging on their walls?
I hadn't thought about this. Yeah. I mean, it's a very interesting open question whether they should talk about the dark side of Henry Habermeyer. You know, there's a Habermeyer bequest. They had an exhibition on the Habermeyers. But no, they didn't mention that. There's also something that's really an interesting part of my book is the sheer criminality of Henry Habermeyer. So in addition to starting the Sugar Trust, which really was in violation of antitrust laws, one of the things that they did is they had to pay a duty, an import tax, on the tons and tons of raw sugar that came into the United States. And they had massive scales that would weigh the sugar. And then based on these weighings, they paid the tax. At some point, the Habermeyers put a spring into these scales so that they massively underweighed the amount of sugar that was being weighed and cheated the government out of tens of millions of dollars. And then finally, in 1907, an honest inspector discovered these springs, and the man who ran the dock said, if you just pretend that you never saw this, you can name your price. We will pay any price to you just to forget this. And he was one of those rare, honest officials, and he said, no way.
And this made it all the way up to the President of the United States.
Teddy Roosevelt said, I don't care how rich and powerful Habermeyer is, I want to see justice done. This man belongs in prison. He has cheated the government out of huge amounts of money. And the stress from knowing that he was going to get prosecuted and probably end up in prison drove Henry Habermeyer to an early grave. So he dies at 60, largely in fear of going to prison. There's also one other thing that they did. So they used huge amounts of city water to cool the factory. And at one point, they had a secret water line that went around the meters that was bringing in tens of thousands of gallons of water illegally a day. And then eventually that was discovered too. So it wasn't just that Henry Habermeyer was a ruthless businessman. I mean, there were clear criminal aspects to the business that he was running. And that's part of the problem I have with the book that his grandson wrote. Harry Habermeyer wrote a book called The Most Independent Mind about Henry Habermeyer. He completely ignores this. So it's a glaring admission and part of the reason why I wanted to write my book, because the criminality is central to the Habermeyer story.
Jeffrey, we're going to give you a rest for a second. On the other side of the break, I'd like for you to share with us how it feels when you walk into a supermarket and you look at a bag of sugar, knowing what you know now. If you want to stay up to date with new interviews and real estate news, sales and rental market reports, all kinds of new listings, events, and so much more, just text the word Brooklyn to 66866 to join our exclusive Brooklyn Made email list. So spotting sugar in the grocery store, what emotions does that evoke now knowing what you know?
Well, one thing is I'm just aware of how many people died and how many lives were ruined to produce this product. It's really given me, the research has given me an appreciation of how much suffering went into to refining sugar. The plant has a long history, so I cut my story off at 1909, but it ran to 2005. And in the late 1990s, I was training for the marathon, and I would run over the Williamsburg Bridge, and when they were refining sugar, the smell would waft clear over to the Manhattan side. You could smell it. And that's the way the neighborhood smelled for generations. You know, so I have a real sort of a visceral attachment to sugar. I can still kind of remember that scent. There's also a man who's in his 80s who worked in the refinery in the 1950s. And he tells a story of how a worker fell into one of the machines and literally his body was cut up and cubed. So whenever I look at a bag of sugar, that story sticks in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
But so it's the human cost of producing sugar.
This becomes very personal to you. Yes, you can tell.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I was going to ask about the Union soldiers. I was interested in the fact that they were rationed 15 pounds of sugar a month, which is way more than can be consumed. What did the soldiers do with that much sugar that they needed new 15 pounds each month?
You know, one of the things that's interesting is when you publish a book, very intelligent people read your book and give you insights and things that you never would have thought about. So, for a long time, that question puzzled me. And then one of my readers suggested something that makes a lot of sense. So part of the reason why they got so much sugar is that they were able to turn the 13 pounds of sugar that they got monthly as a ration into booze.
It's ingenious, actually.
You know? Right. Yeah. And I think that explanation makes the most sense, mm-hmm. that they were cooking up moonshine all the time.
Sure. Jeffrey, we can't not talk about the Sherman Act of 1890. Let's talk about the influence that had.
Well, it's interesting. So they formed the Sugar Trust in 1887, and then shortly afterwards, New York State sued them and said that the trust was illegal. Hmm. And New York State won. So what do? They reincorporated in New Jersey, and they were able to continue and run the Sugar Trust all through Henry Havemeyer's life. But one of the stories that I tell is about how he bribed politicians. So we have a McCarran Park on the border of Williamsburg and Greenpoint, and Patrick McCarran was called the sugar senator. Patrick McCarran was one of the first modern lobbyists, and he shamelessly represented the interests of the sugar industry in Albany and was paid huge retainers. And so on the state level, there were never any laws that were passed to protect the workers in the factory, any state laws that protected consumers. But on the national level, Henry Havemeyer was very, very interested in the tariff, in lowering the tariff, because he had to pay for the raw sugar that came in. So he contributed heavily to the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party won in 1884. Grover Cleveland won the election. And then Henry Havemeyer went down to Washington and said, "Gentlemen, do you remember me? Do you remember how much money I gave to get the president elected?" And his personal friend was the Secretary of the Treasury, who said, "We have to look out for this man. We would not have won this election without Havemeyer." But Havemeyer also did something. He said to the senators, "If you pass legislation that's beneficial to me and the Sugar Trust, you stand to make money. So buy stock in the Sugar Trust, pass the legislation that I need, and you're going to reap profits. And a number of them did. And there were no ethics laws. They could get away with it. So it's on many, many levels, on the state level, on the federal level, on the city level, right? Government did not work. It did not function to either to protect the consumers or to protect the workers in the factory. And then much of what I talk about is Henry Habermas's attempt to destroy anybody who came into competition with him. So there was another German immigrant named Klaus Spreckels, who became the sugar king of California. And the Habermas tried to destroy him. They ended up fighting a sugar war that cost both sides millions of dollars. And eventually they had to come to an agreement. There was also a family of coffee producers called the Arbuckles. And they ended up in Brooklyn. And one of the things that they realized was that the consumers preferred bagged sugar to sugar in barrels. And they bought the patent for a bagger. And they started to resell Habermas sugar in the sugar bags that we know now. So what's interesting is the Habermas said, sell us the bagger. And the Arbuckle said, no way, we're not going to do it. And it started the war. They tried to enter the coffee business to force the Arbuckles out of business. The Arbuckles ended up setting up a sugar refinery, and there was this war, each one trying to destroy the other, that again cost tens of millions of dollars before it was settled. And then one of the last things I describe in the book is that there are two different kinds of sugar. So there's cane sugar, and then there's beet sugar. He shipped huge amounts of sugar to the West and sold it below cost to drive the beet sugar producers out of business. And once they were at his mercy, he bought up all their sugar producing capacity and integrated it into the trust. So for many years, Henry Habermas could, from his office on Wall Street, set the price of 98% of the American sugar. He had fantastic power, fantastic economic leverage.
So let's talk about his family that's living today.
So after his death, there was an investigation, and one of the things that they found out was that Henry Habermas had received a huge amount of stock in the American Sugar Refining Company without any compensation. In other words, he just gave himself $100 million worth of stock, and it violates the Securities and Exchange Commission law. So the family had to divest, and eventually the sugar monopoly was broken up by the government. But they still held huge amounts of shares of stock, and they had millions of dollars. So his daughter, Electra, set up the foremost museum of Americana in Vermont. I'm forgetting the name of the museum off the top of my head. And then the grandson, who I believe has passed away, but was still around in the 2000s, he became a kind of family historian, published books about his grandfather and about his great-great-grandfather. There's still Habermas around, and they're still wealthy people.
Not everybody knows the story behind it, though. I don't think I'll ever look at sugar in the supermarket again the same way, for sure.
Right. Yeah. So one of my readers just told me a story, or wrote me an email, and said that she was working in a publishing house, and one of the scions of the family was there, and he got in an argument and he got fired. And she said, oh, poor, I think it was Henry. One of the other workers said, don't worry about him, right? He inherited tens of millions of dollars at birth. He only did this as a hobby. So they're still around.
No kidding.
It was a large family, and there are really many different branches of it. One of the things that I talked about is, Henry's uncle was three-time mayor of New York City. So they there was a branch that went into politics and was also very, very successful. It was but it was a large family. And here in Greenpoint, there were cousins who also operated a sugar refinery that became part of the trust. It's a large family with a number of branches.
So what's happening to the modern Domino Sugar building?
This building is landmark, and it's going to be rapidly changed, rapidly transformed into something that's really different than what it's been. So it was set up as an industrial building where thousands of workers worked, where people died. And now it's going to be luxury offices and luxury condos. I think that's progress. I think that's what happens over time. But I would like the people remember that there's a different story to this building, and then this building has a unique and tragic history that should be remembered and recalled. And my fear is that somehow this really unique history will be forgotten. And that's a lot of the reason why I wrote the book, is I think it's an important history. It's an important part of Brooklyn history, important part of American history that should be remembered.
Very beautifully said. Jeff, how can people get a hold of you and find out more about your work?
I have a website. You can look for Jeffrey Cobb, writer.
And that's Jeffrey with a G, right?
Right. You can purchase the book on Amazon. And then Word Bookstore here in Greenpoint and Spoonbill Bookstore in Williamsburg carries the book. And I do a number of speaking engagements. I'd be really happy for people to learn this really unique, important story.
Now, you said you do speaking engagements. Do you have anything coming up?
Yeah. So the Parks Department approached me. May 5th is the anniversary of Jane Jacobs' birth, the great urbanist. Mm-hmm. So all over the United States and all over the world, people lead walks in cities. So I'm going to be leading a walk through Bushwick Inlet Park and McCarran Park, talking about the early history of Brooklyn, the Native American history of Brooklyn, and the rise of industrialization, including the sugar industry. And it's free, and I'd love for people to come out.
So again, to contact Jeffrey Cobb for more information, you can go to Jeffrey Cobb Writer, and that's Jeffrey with a G. And in the beginning of the show, we mentioned stick around. We've got something fun at the end to talk to you about. Well, Jeffrey's agreed to sign 5 of his books, The Rise and Fall of the Sugar King. So the first 5 emails to the Brooklyn Made Show, we'll get those. So go ahead and send your full name, your full address, and email it to contact@brooklynmade.blog. And we cannot say goodbye before we thank Michael Kowachka from Warren Lewis Sotheby's International Realty for arranging the interview with Jeffrey Cobb. Very special show today. Thank you for being part of it. And as always, be sure to go to iTunes and rate the show and share this with friends. Be sure to subscribe and we'll chat again. It's the Brooklyn Made Show.
For you, the listeners of Brooklyn Made Podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you the opportunity to check out their service. Please go to our special link and get your free copy at brooklynmadebook.com. Also, check out our preferred vendors page on our website, brooklynmade.blog, or at ratnerteamvendors.com. You can also download our new preferred vendors app in the Apple Store. Also, check out our resources page where we recommend essential tools and companies to grow your business. We hope that you found this episode valuable. We'd love to hear your opinion, so please leave a review. Be sure to subscribe to updates on our Brooklyn Made website to gain free access to countless insights into Brooklyn real estate, culture, and business. You can follow this series on iTunes, podcast, or via our blog at brooklynmade.blog. You can also listen to all of our episodes on our Ratner Team YouTube channel. Contact our team for a complimentary consultation with one of our real estate specialists to discuss your real estate goals and needs. You can reach us anytime at contact@theratnerteam.com or simply dial 347-762-0275. Thank you again for tuning in and have a great week.